Good afternoon. My name is Scott Robinson. I'm here arguing the case of Eugene Avaloff. I've got a little bit of a head cold, so I'll do my best to make myself understandable. I would like to start with the final argument that I presented in the briefs, because I think it is dispositive and it would result in there being no need to resolve or even consider the other four issues, which were all evidentiary issues that arose during trial. The no retreat part of our self-defense law is over a century old, and it was reiterated strongly as recently as the Idrigo case, in which the Supreme Court held again for something like the 12th time that in order to defend yourself or others, you need not retreat from an affray. That principle of no retreat is very important from a practical point of view. I've tried a number of self-defense cases, and sometimes jurors have this belief that you should, in fact, retreat. I had a case in which they thought you ought to jump off a porch, a second-story porch, in order to get away from an event. Well, in this case, although there was no contemporaneous objection, so it's a plain error issue, the jury was not told that Eugene Avaloff did not have to retreat in order to defend others. And that was the principal issue of the defense. As you know from reading the briefs, the defense that justified the use of the chair by Avaloff was based on his essentially keeping the Hazel group at bay, as I analogized it in the brief, to a lion keeping back the cats. That doesn't work, though, if you have a duty to retreat. And while instruction number 13 correctly told the jury that Avaloff himself need not retreat in order to defend himself, it failed to tell them that he had no duty to retreat vis-a-vis defense of others either. If that was all it would still be significant. But the instruction also included the statutory discussion of provocation and the effect that provocation has. And that's very important in this case. If you look at People versus Silva, which is the leading case on the use of the provocation exception to self-defense, it makes very clear that we don't take provocation lightly. Provocation is only something you instruct the jury when there is evidence that the defendant, not somebody else, but the defendant, did something to provoke a show of force from another under the guise or the pretext, and those are words lifted directly from Silva, of trying to get that person, basically trick that person into a fight. That's the only proper purpose of provocation. And in this case, there was no evidence of provocation by Eugene Avaloff. Taking the evidence of the prosecution witnesses only, taking it at face value, the testimony was that Avaloff got involved in a fight between Rodriguez and Hazel by allegedly striking Hazel over the head with a chair. That's not an act of provocation, that's an act of aggression. And the reason I did not brief the initial aggression issue was precisely for that, because the jury was also instructed on the law of initial aggression. So what happened in the trial court, and I think what happened on appeal as well, is that there's a tendency to confuse initial aggressor and provocation.
So there was evidence in the record that four people came to the apartment building, surrounded the people who were there, acted in an aggressive and threatening manner. Do you think that constitutes provocation?
I don't, and there's a wealth of cases, none of which were briefed by either side, that make clear that mere words are never provocation. And I don't think looming or lurking is what the statute means. And if you look at Silva certainly seems to indicate it takes more than even an ongoing dispute. In Silva, there was, as I recall, some interaction between two different groups. And the Court of Appeals in that leading case held that that was inadequate evidence of provocation, because provocation is something specific. It's not the same as initial aggression. So in my view, lurking, looming, being threatening, that's some evidence of initial aggression. But I don't believe it's sufficient evidence of provocation. And while I'm on the theme of initial aggression and provocation, I would point out that a case that I did not cite, but that the state did, which is, I think, the leading case on initial aggression, that's the Beasley case, makes clear, and it's in this context of initial aggression, but I think it also applies to provocation, that if you improperly instruct jurors in a self-defense case on either provocation or initial aggression, you're basically misleading the jury. You're putting that judicial imprimatur of approval on it, saying, well, the judge thinks that he's the initial aggressor, or the judge thinks that there was provocation. So it's very important that those aspects of our self-defense law only be instructed in those cases where it's appropriate. In this case, there was enough evidence to support the initial aggression part. There was not enough to support provocation. And these issues interrelate very intimately.
Before you go on, Mr. Robinson, there was some evidence in the record that one of the individuals tried to do a bear hug.
Yes.
And that was refused, apparently.
Yes.
Isn't that more than simply mere words where they're trying to could it be interpreted as a subterfuge to say, gee, things are okay, when in fact what they're going to do is wrestle a person to the ground or something like that?
Could
qualify as the provocation?
It could, but that wasn't Eugene Avila.
That's right, him. Someone else was.
Yes, there. So that's a very pertinent fact-based question, but my answer to it is it wasn't Eugene Avila. It was clearly Arnold Rodriguez, who was involved face-to-face with the much larger Christopher Hazel, and it clearly a fray started between them. The intimate relationship between these issues is illustrated also by how they can be confused. It's urged on appeal that essentially, and this is the way I read it, the evidence showed that Eugene Avila was the initial aggressor as a matter of law, so it doesn't matter if the jury wasn't properly instructed on retreat. That's the reading I get from the answer brief. And of course, that's just, that misstates the law on several different counts. The question of whether and who is the initial aggressor is absolutely a jury question when there's appropriate evidence, which there was in this case. But the jury's determination of the lack of a duty to retreat in defense of others isn't established because you can argue that maybe the jury believed that someone in the Avila group was the initial aggressor. I mean, that puts the cart not behind the horse, it puts the cart somewhere back in the lower 40, because if you in fact have raised self-defense or defense of others, both of which were adequately raised in this case, and the jury is considering whether you're an initial aggressor, it's altogether more important that the jury be properly instructed on retreat, the absence of a duty to retreat. So too, it doesn't matter that there was no evidence of retreat, as was urged in the answer brief. Again, that's a complete misstatement of the law. The whole point is that we're trying to tell the jury, you don't have to retreat in order to use self-defense or defend another.
Does it matter that the one instruction was given on the affirmative defense of self-defense specifically referred to third persons?
I think it helps, but it never said you didn't have to retreat in order to defend third persons. In other words, in the instruction, as the court knows, the instruction on self-defense included defense of others, but the instruction on non-retreat did not. And, you know, we can make an assumption, but in a self-defense case, it's not appropriate to make assumptions.
So your argument is that that was a critical part of the defense.
Yes.
And yet, the defense counsel didn't notice that or make any argument about it. How is that then plain error for the court not?
Well, a plain error is what we determine plain error to be, an error that's fundamental. And in this case, lawyers do in fact make mistakes. And the mistake that the lawyer did, and I think it was a grievous one, was to failure to object to the absence of a reference to the non-retreat.
He did argue that as his defense.
Oh, absolutely.
And did the state argue that he wasn't entitled to retreat if he was defending others, that he was required to retreat if he defended others?
My recollection of the closings on both sides is that the issue of retreat was not hotly contested. But that doesn't mean that the jury didn't consider it. I've never viewed that as a significant factor in terms of appellate work, because to me, what matters is that we instruct the jury properly, not whether the lawyers seized or did not seize on an issue. If I could skip very briefly to issue number three, I just want to note, I want to supplement my argument on the issue of the officer, Zachary Phillips, determining what had happened. I did cite the case of People versus Mullins, but the time I cited it, I didn't know that Judge Todman would be part of the division. I think that the Mullins decision is, in fact, a very important one, because it indicates how it is not fair to stack the deck towards conviction by injecting evidence of, in that case, the process by which an arrest warrant affidavit was obtained. And I do cite the Mullins case, but I want to make a special note of it. I emphasized the Kuhn and Tevlin line of cases, and of course the I also emphasized the Liggett decision. But I think Mullins also tells us why it's just not fair to permit the officer who's testifying to create a consensus conclusion that he and the other officers determined that it was Avila's group that was aggressive and that Hazel was struck from behind with a chair.
Mr. Robinson, couldn't, if there had been one investigating police officer, couldn't he or she have testified to that?
If it had not been based on hearsay and lack of foundation, which were the objections that were raised, perhaps.
But what about the applicability of the fellow officer rule? Wouldn't that allow a police officer to say, based upon the investigation by not just me, but by other officers, this is what we determined?
In my view, the fellow officer rule has a secure and valid place in the Fourth Amendment pantheon of case law. We don't permit officers to testify about what a fellow officer did or what they found in a jury trial. It's hearsay. It's complete and utter hearsay, and it's also violates the Confrontation Clause, because if Officer A testifies about what Officer B would have said had he testified at trial, then we don't have any confrontation to Officer B. But I agree the fellow officer rule is established in the law, but I would think it was securely in its proper position over there in the Fourth Amendment search and seizure field. I don't think it's okay for even a lead detective to summarize all of what the other officers heard from their investigation and say, we determined that the Avila group was the aggressive group, and we determined that Hazel was hit from behind, both of which were hotly contested issues. Are there any other questions, or may I maintain my minute 50? Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Joseph Michaels, attorney registration number 40403, and I'm here on behalf of the state of Colorado. Three things occurred to me as I was reviewing the briefs and records in preparation for this argument, two of which I think will be very helpful in your resolution of this case, and one of which was an oversight on my part, so it doesn't reflect as well on me as I would like. The first one I'm going to talk about actually is parallel with what Mr. Robinson talked about, and that's the jury instruction issue. And as he admitted, it's a plain error instruction, and what we're really talking about, when it all boils down to this, is look at instruction 13. And instruction 13 is the instruction about self-defense and the defense of others. And if you'll permit me, I'm going to do a quick read of it just to contextualize. And the first part says, it's an affirmative defense if the defendant, in order to defend himself or a third person, used force reasonably necessary. So far, so good. The second part it says immediately after that, that the defendant is not required to retreat or claim the right to employ force in his defense if he is the initial aggressor, et cetera, et cetera. And what we're really arguing about here is the absence of those two words, as Judge Nieto, you pointed out. And that's the two words, or others, in his defense or others' defense. And what we have here is we have a compound jury instruction that specifically encompasses talking about self-defense of himself and of the third person, in this case, the three other people involved with his group. The entire trial is about self-defense of others. So there's no way that the jury is going to look at that and say, oh, he must have retreated in order to defend himself, but not others. They're not going to separate that. They're not going to parse it that closely in the same way that we parse it. And they're certainly not going to be able to separate it out when the instruction is put together so that it's supposed to focus on the defense of others. The question that we have to ask and we have to answer is, did this omission preclude the jury from considering defense of others? And the answer clearly is no. The reason we know this is because both sides argue defense of others as late as closing arguments, never mind throughout the entire trial. I agree that its absence, it would have been better for it to have been in there. However, it's not plain error, and it certainly wasn't something that bothered either the defense counsel at the time, or the prosecution, or the trial court. There's absolutely no way it rises to plain error. The second thing that occurred to me actually had to do with the second issue, and I just want to touch on it briefly because I think it is an important issue, and that's the issue of the defense witness's silence. And the thing that occurred to me is that it's not really about post-arrest silence. We're not talking about the defendant. We're not talking about a comment on a defendant's post-arrest silence. We're talking about a defense witness. And we're still not talking about a comment on the defense witness's post-arrest silence. Neither are we talking about evidence of guilt that's being admitted to hurt the defendant. If you have a question, by all means. What we're talking about is we're talking about an extended silence after the defense witness admitted his involvement in this affray, altercation, brouhaha, whatever you want to call it, but he was never arrested for this incident. There's no evidence that he was ever Mirandized for this incident, and we're talking about relevance. We're not talking about constitutional rights. We're talking about what relevance, and the relevance is the credibility of this particular witness. Now, there are two cases that are important, both of which are cited, I believe, in the answer brief. The first one is People versus Chavez, and People versus Chavez directly talks about the other case, a U.S. Supreme Court case, that says constitutionally protected post-Miranda advisement silence, if relevant to rebut a claim asserted by the defendant at trial, is admissible. That's exactly what we're doing here. The defendant at trial came up with this story that... Sorry, this microphone keeps falling down a little bit. Came up with a story that he was defending others. He was the lion tamer, taming the lions and keeping them at bay. Well, that's fine, but he never came forward. He never discussed this. And so it's an issue that directly impacts his credibility. What we have is not talking about the specific silence after in the moments after the police arrived, broke up the fight, and made their determinations of what happened. What we're talking about is this guy never, ever, not in the same transaction, decided to come forward with this, never discussed the fact that what we're talking about is rebutting a claim. So what we've got here is not a comment on post-arrest silence, but a comment on his delay in presenting the story, which is not...
He was arrested on an outstanding warrant, was he not?
Yes, he was arrested on an outstanding warrant for something entirely unrelated to this, and unfortunately the record doesn't indicate what that warrant was.
But I mean, following his arrest, doesn't the right to silence attach?
Yes, the right to silence attaches. However, we're not talking about the fact that he was silent about that particular arrest. We're talking about that he never talked about this, never not just that transaction, but ever and ever and ever and ever, continuing on up to the first day of trial, when he says, this is the story and this is credible.
Does he have a duty to come forward?
I don't believe he necessarily has a duty, but it is valid for the prosecution to be able to probe it, as long as he's not drawing negative inferences.
Mr. Michaels, what's the difference between a defense witness not saying something immediately after being arrested as opposed to not saying something within a week or 2 weeks after being arrested? Isn't it silence one way or the other?
In that case, it is silence one way or another. But the concern of People versus Cole and People versus Robinson, even People United States versus Robinson, and even People versus Chavez, was the fact that an innocent person immediately after being arrested might be so frightened about being arrested that that silence could just as easily be reflective of any number of things. Whereas when you get farther and farther away from that initial transaction, as you will, you start to have the fear and the questioning and all that dissipates, and you still have the ability to then, again, probe the credibility of the witness.
Are there any cases that make that distinction that you've just made for us?
I believe People versus Chavez does, which is cited in the brief, but I can give you that cite if you'd like. And that's...
You can get the cite from the brief, that's fine.
Sure. Thank you. And there's a... I think it's in the initial brief, but if not, it's directly cited by People versus Chavez, and that's United States versus Robinson. And that's 485 U.S. 25. Are there any other questions about the second issue? Good. I'd like to touch really quickly on that third issue. And I think... The third issue that Mr. Robinson talked about the officer's determination, the first thing that I want to touch on is that he suddenly seems to be reaffirming that it's an issue of hearsay and foundational and proper foundation. That's not what the briefs discussed. The briefs discussed whether it was a proper determination. And it's the fact that it's a proper determination, that issue wasn't raised, wasn't objected to, and wasn't ruled on at the trial court, which is to say it's plain error. There's a plethora of case law out there that says the failure to object in trial court on the grounds now asserted on appeal waives the objection. So I would urge this court to look at this under the plain error standard. But even if it doesn't, it doesn't matter, because officers are allowed to talk about what they determine happened. And even if you want to filter out everything that hypothetically all the other officers told this one particular testifying officer, you still have this officer saying, hey, look, I saw a massive SUV that had been run up onto the curb. There were beer cans around. There were broken chairs. None of the defendant's group lived in this apartment complex, with the exception of one person who had a distant relative in that apartment complex. And all the other people involved in the fight were people who lived in that apartment complex. That alone is enough to occupy as a determination, if you will.
That doesn't seem to be the issue that they're framing, though. I mean, not whether the SUV was on the curb or anything else, but who started the fight.
Right. And this all goes into that determination that this particular officer made, looking at the circumstances leading up to the fight. And even if not, under Tenorio and under the fellow officer rule, you have this ability for the detectives, for the police officers, to be able to say, well, wait a minute, we learned from witness X, not saying that this is what we believe is true, but this is the effect that it had on us, even if we evaluate this under a hearsay standard.
Well, that was from what he was saying, was that he didn't say we did thus and so because we had determined this. It was offered as a summary of what the officer decided was the fact, wasn't it?
It was offered as how they determined what caused them to act in the way that they did. I don't believe that they're taking it as the truth of the matter, and that's what the trial court specifically ruled on, that they weren't offering the witnesses, the victims and the participants' statements because of their truth, but because it impacted how the officers acted, who they ended up arresting, and how they decided to proceed from that level. It explains, in short, how they investigated it. And they're not vouching for the victims, they're not vouching for the credibility of one side versus the other. they're really figuring out what they did, why they did it, and how they proceeded from that. The last thing I just want to talk about, unless there are any other questions about that issue, the last thing I want to spend my time on is that first issue, and that's the issue of the election, chair versus bottle. And that's the third issue that I came up with. And I want to offer my apologies to this court for not setting out in my brief the exact exchange of May 28th, 2008. I thought I had, and when I reread the briefs and I reread the reply, I realized I had not. But even the fact that I did not doesn't change the fact that we win on this for four different reasons. The first is that it's an absolutely moot issue. He wasn't convicted of second-degree assault with a bottle. He was convicted of a chair. There was no practical effect on the conviction, and there are, again, a plethora of cases that say a complaint that a jury was allowed to consider, even improperly, an offense of which the defendant was acquitted, is rendered moot on appeal. I have a few of those cited in my brief. I have six more sites in front of me that I'm more than happy to rattle off at you, but I know there are better ways I can spend my time.
Mr. Michael, what is your response to Mr. Robinson's contention that the jurors may have made a compromise verdict because of they thought that they could choose and maybe the defendant would get a less severe punishment if they only found him guilty of one object rather than both?
I'm glad you asked that. And there was a unanimity instruction delivered with the verdict form that allowed the jurors to check one chair, two bottle, or three chair and bottle.
But that doesn't really respond, I don't think, to Mr. Robinson's point, because as I understand his contention, if the jurors thought that the defendant might get a lesser penalty if he were convicted of only using one object rather than both, wouldn't that have inured to the prosecution's benefit?
There's no indication in the record that there was any concern of that at the time. There was no offer of proof made as to what he would have done differently. The only thing they said at trial, and even in the opening brief here, is that it made the defense more difficult. Well, the fact was it didn't make the defense more difficult because the jury didn't buy into the bottle throwing. And even if the jury did hear the testimony, the jury was still going to hear that there was a bottle being thrown. It goes back into this very same lion tamer analogy. If you're holding ferocious felines at bay with just a chair, oh, look, there's a rock on the ground. Oh, look, there's a glass bottle on the ground. You're going to throw it to keep those felines at bay. The same analogy applies here. The testimony is still going to come in, and it's just as possible that the jury would have taken that testimony and said, oh, he's using a rock. Had the glass bottle not been allowed to be used at all in trial, for example, it was very possible the jury would have done the reverse and said, oh, he's got a chair and a glass bottle. That means we're definitely going to convict him. So all of this is speculative without any sort of record evidence of it.
Would the evidence concerning the bottle come in if the court had ruled an election was made?
Yes, it would have.
And how would it come in?
It's still part of the testimony. It just wouldn't have been the underlying weapon for the second-degree assault. The last thing, does that answer your question? The last thing I want to say just very briefly is, even if it had been an unequivocal election on May 28th, CRIM P7E is extremely liberal and would have allowed the prosecution to re-amend it even prior to trial, even on the day of trial, because the trial hadn't started at that point. So even all that, on top of it, with all the evidence in the defendant's favor, would have allowed the amendment. I'm out of time. I thank you for your time, and people ask that you affirm all the convictions. Thank you.
On the issue of Officer Zachary Phillips' determination, the objections at the time were hearsay and lack of foundation. But the court can't ignore the consequences of the erroneous ruling on those objections. And that's why I focused in the briefs about the consequences of that, that it was akin to commenting on the credibility of a witness. That's not something that you could ignore. And of course, I did in fact refer to the hoary hearsay rule in my briefs as well. So it's not like we didn't brief it on the question of foundation and relevance. But that's why it is not plain error. But that gives me just a short period of time to talk about plain error. The Mullins case I discussed earlier was in fact a plain error case. Our case law is replete with plain error determinations. The reality of our justice system is that sometimes lawyers and judges make errors. And the fact that the defense attorney in this case didn't realize that he should have objected to the provocation language and didn't realize that he should have objected to the failure to indicate that you need not retreat in defense of others, that's just a mistake. And the fact that the court didn't pick it up either doesn't tell us anything about whether it is or is not plain error. The reality is that that's why we have appellate judges and appellate courts, because sometimes people are frail and make mistakes. Do you have any questions about any of the issues? I have 8 seconds to spend answering them. Thank you for your time.
Thank you both for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.